Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Howard Dodson. I'm director of the Schomburg Center. It's my pleasure to welcome you here this evening for what is actually the inaugural program of our 2009-2010 program season. That program will feature a special lecture as well as an award presentation that we frankly rarely do, but felt that the individual who will be coming before you this evening was certainly worthy of receiving that award, and to have him in the house and have the opportunity to present it to them is of great honor and privilege and pleasure on my part. Let me say that by way of background, I had the privilege of going to Botswana about 2 or 3 weeks ago for the first time, and had heard something of the Botswana story. But as you know, in the public media in the United States, you hear relatively little about what's transpiring in Botswana. And indeed, if you look at the public media, what you are most likely to hear is about the crime and corruption that's taking place in this country, or the very bad government, or the very bad economic problems that are being created in this society or that one or the other. The good stories, the winning stories, the victory stories that are taking place in Africa are usually kept away from us, especially here in the United States. And having the privilege of going to Botswana and to see for myself what, quite frankly, a miracle has been wrought by human hands over the last 40-plus years was one of the most inspiring and invigorating experiences that I've had on the continent of Africa, quite frankly, since I've been going there. I say that with no sense of apologies to any of the other places that I've been, but simply as a recognition of the extraordinary achievements that I witnessed during my relatively brief visit there. What did I see? A country that was whose people were actively involved in its political and social and economic life. A country where the wealth of the country could be seen in the country, in the people that are there, in the institutions that are there, in the infrastructure that has been built. You perhaps don't know this, but at the time that Botswana received its independence in 1966, it was one of the poorest countries in Africa. And now, 43 years later, is ranked among the middle-class countries of the world. And that achievement has been made because of very judicious and responsible political leadership, because of a very strong commitment to the people of the country, because of a quite frankly, an understanding of what the real function of government is in a society, which is to serve as the custodian of the nation and its resources in behalf of the people of the nation. Unfortunately, far too many of our African nations in the post-colonial period have not come to their post-colonial national leadership with that kind of consciousness. This was the case in Botswana. And I came away from there having visited the mines and seen the ways in which the diamond industry has been a partner, quite frankly, with Botswana and its development. Thoroughly impressed with what I saw, but equally importantly, as a result of my meeting with the president, thoroughly impressed with the quality of both his life, his leadership, and his contributions to the development of that country. And it's with that realization in mind that I have the privilege this evening of presenting to President Mohai the highest honor that the Schomburg Center presents to anyone who have made significant contributions to the African and African diaspora and world. I'm speaking of our Africana Heritage Award. Now, let me, before going too far, acknowledge the presence of a few people who are here. The ambassador and permanent representative of the permanent mission of the Republic of Botswana, Ambassador Ntwaye, is here, I believe. Ambassador. And the individual who frankly invited me to go to Botswana and see for myself and to work with us to make this program possible, the CEO of Debswana, which is the private-public partnership that basically manages the mines of Botswana, Ms. Sheila Khama. I received several letters from individuals, communications actually, from individuals who wanted to be here but could not, but what did want to send messages to the president. One of them is from the governor of the state of New York, Governor David Patterson, and he sends a letter to you. The concluding paragraph of which is, President Mogae is a champion of his people and of all people of African descent. And for this reason, he has earned the respect and admiration of our global community. On behalf of all New Yorkers, I respectfully join with those present in applauding President Festus Mogae on a lifetime of stalwart achievement. A letter from Governor David Patterson. There's also a communication from the Secretary General of the United Nations, who obviously, because the General Assembly opened, could not be with us, and but he did send words saying that President Mogae has also been a strong advocate of African-owned and African-led development and of partnerships with civil society, the media, the private sector, and others as vital means to advance this cause. I'm particularly grateful to President Mogae for his passionate efforts to mobilize international action on climate change, one of the leading global challenges of our times. He has rightly stated that the stakes could not be higher. I'm grateful for the Schomburg Center, which is a renowned scholarship, and for its scholarship and excellence, for recognizing President Mogae with this prestigious award, and wish him all the success in his future endeavors. Letters from the Secretary General of the United Nations. And now I would like to, in my capacity as director of the Schomburg Center, present the Africana Heritage Award to President Mogae. And just a very brief explanation of why we're doing this. President Mogae is a man of high moral and ethical standards, a dedicated public servant, a principled and responsible custodian of the resources of his country, and an incorruptible servant of the people of Botswana. Botswana, as you know, has distinguished itself as one of the most stable and democracies in post-colonial Africa. It has also developed from one of the poorest countries in Africa to one that is ranked among the middle-class countries of the world. Our honoree tonight has been centrally involved in fostering Botswana's economic and political development for the past 40 years. 2 years after independence in 1968, he entered government service in the Ministry of Development and Planning. He continued in the Ministry of Finance and Development in 1970 and became the Minister of Finance and Development Planning from 1989 to 1998. He served as Vice President from 1992 to 1998 and as President from 1998 to 2008, for virtually all of the 40 years of Botswana's development, he has been centrally involved in both fostering government policy and fostering economic policy. He is an economist, and the thing that I congratulate him on most is that he and his predecessors as president recognized the fact that the resources belong to the people. And his special contribution to that was that he knew enough about the economy, and I'll talk about the capitalist world economy, to figure out how to both protect the people and advance their interests. And so I, on behalf of the Schomburg Center and in recognition of the central role he has played in shaping Botswana's model-worthy economic development program and fostering the development of its people through judicious investments in their and the country's development, I'm pleased to present this, the 2009 Africana Heritage Award, to His Excellency the Honorable Festus Magai, the third president of the Democratic Republic of Botswana. Be pleased to report.
I think, where's the photographer? You don't want to get a copy. Yeah.
Can't see it either. Yeah, we'll come over here. And now, without further ado, I'm pleased to present President Magai, who will present the lecture of the day. Please welcome President Magai.
Dr. Dodson, my country, my compatriots, friends from the United States, good evening. I'm delighted and humbled by the award I have just received from the Schomburg Center. Which I am told has been given to a number of very famous people. I'm very proud of that because I have some vanity. You know, in Shakespeare's Merchant of Venice, there is said to have been a man who spoke more nonsense than most men in Venice. But he was renowned wise because he kept the company of wise men. I claim that I'm clever enough to be able to do exactly that, keep the company of wise men. And that is why now I am given this prestigious award, which has been given to outstanding personalities whose competence I cannot hope to equal, let alone surpass. But all I am sure of is that from today, when their names are mentioned, as the recipient of this award, mine will also be mentioned. As a result of not knowing enough about me, of which there is very little to know, you will have no option but to believe. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I have been asked to talk to you tonight, to interact with you, in the context of speeches I made at both Cornell and Boston universities on what we Africans expect from the Obama administration and the subsequent address that the president himself made or gave to the Ghanaian parliament in Accra. And just to recall some of the things I said, I had said that we expect the present good relations between sub-Saharan Africa and the United States to continue, and that we expected President Obama to visit Africa because his predecessors, one Democrat and one Republican, in the persons of Bill Clinton and George Bush, had both visited Africa. I had said that we did not expect President Obama to discontinue that practice, which is becoming a tradition, whereby an incumbent president of the most powerful nation on earth visits our continent. In the event the president has hastened to visit the continent, starting with a country that has a special place in the annals of African liberation from colonial rule, namely Ghana. However, it has to be remembered that Africa is a continent and not a country. Ghana is in the western region. There is an eastern region and a central region, and of course, a southern region from whence my compatriot sitting here among you come, from where we come. Both Clinton and Bush visited at least three of the regions. And so the president had started very well, but we still expect him to come back to sub-Saharan Africa. And by the way, the Nigerians have said that if Ghana is the gateway to Africa, Nigeria is the ultimate destination. Well, I had said that among the things I had made, that we Africans are acutely aware of the constraints under which any American president operates. Nonetheless, we expect a great deal from the president for the simple reason that we consider him part of our kith and kin. We love and identify with him, and we are happy that he seems to be one of those American presidents who generate much passion and enthusiasm in the traditions of the Kennedys and Clinton. But we are aware that he is facing the worst economic problem since the collapse, the market collapse of 1929, that the challenge he faces is unprecedented in magnitude and it in global terms, and that his first obligation is to attend to the needs of the American people. And secondly, to the imperatives of global leadership by the United States. Any attention to Africa can come only as part of his global initiatives, which as president of the most powerful nation on earth, he is expected to and is bound to take. And that, the above notwithstanding, Africans have certain definite expectations of the Obama administration. We expect him to come up with Africa-focused and targeted pro-development policies along the lines of the Africa Growth and Opportunity Act, AGOA, the President Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, PEPFAR, and the Millennium Development Account. AGOA created thousands of jobs in sub-Saharan Africa, including and especially in the least developed countries of the continent. It alleviated poverty through employment creation. PEPFAR, on the other hand, was specifically targeted to sub-Saharan Africa and the Caribbean. It was unprecedented in magnitude and generosity to Africa, where the money was actually spent on the Africans themselves and not on Americans administering it in Africa. It was a response to the fact that sub-Saharan Africa, especially Southern Africa, is the epicenter of the AIDS pandemic and its concomitant tuberculosis epidemic. The Millennium Development Account, of course, is global, was not necessarily targeted at Africa, but at all least developed countries. But as the majority of poor countries are in Africa, it was therefore also a pro-Africa initiative. So we expect the Obama administration to take due cognizance of Africa's genuinely special position regarding the actions that need to be taken in respect of climate change, which is resulting in a global warming to the detriment of Africans who are innocent of the causes of climate change. There is, for instance, an emerging consensus that there should be a special fund to help developing countries' efforts at adaptation and mitigation of the effects of climate change. That this should be accompanied by technology transfers to make adaptation technically feasible. Now, adaptation in the context of climate change will entail, to some extent, Africa foregoing the use of some of its natural resources, such as coal. So financial resources and technology transfers will have to be made to compensate Africa for foregoing the use of its own natural resources, especially coal. Africa will also suffer the worst consequences of climate change, such as drought, food and water shortages, heightened temperatures, sinking coastal areas, etc. And all this in a situation in which Africa has the least or has made the least contribution to the adverse climatological changes that are taking place. Now, in his own way, the president has responded to all the points that I made, the ones that I have mentioned and the ones that I haven't mentioned. He has acknowledged that Africa deserves special attention, not just because we are Africans, but because legitimately, going back again to climate change, that we are going to suffer the worst consequences. And yet, it is globally admitted that we have made the least contribution to the problem in which the international community finds itself. He has also said that, yes, he intends to undertake and provide special packages suitable for Africa. On one condition, or maybe several conditions. One of the conditions is that he is going to fight corruption. He is going to help Africa, provided the Africans are willing to be helped as partners, that he will help Africa to make better use of its own resources, that Africa needs strong institutions, not strong men. Not strong men who change constitutions so that they can stay in power. I agree with that. He says that the United States will help Africa help itself. By promoting democracy, because democracy is the only viable alternative. He says countries that have been democratic are more prosperous than other forms of government, and that is why he will help parliaments perform their oversight functions in African countries, help individuals who do the right things, who create jobs for other people and for themselves. I agree. He also promises that he will make qualitative changes in the assistance made available to Africa by the United States so that most of the dollar transferred to Africa should be spent on Africans themselves and not on American consultants administering the aid that goes to Africa. That is music to our ears, because up to now, We are grateful for the assistance we have received. But the quantum is often, the quantum of assistance to us has always been exaggerated, because normally only half of that comes to us. Half remains in the United States. Take, for instance, the very, very good humanitarian assistance. Food aid, in the form of food aid. The food is purchased in the United States and administered by Americans. It has to be transported in American bottoms. That's not my language, it's the language of the trade. Bottoms in this case mean ships. Insured by American insurance companies, handled by American agents, and all these payments to all these American institutions are now are given as the amount of aid given to Africa. And so, if there is going to be some changes to that, that means that there will be an increase in the assistance we actually receive, even without an actual increase in the amount, if in fact the share of the amount voted, a greater share goes to Africa than was the case previously. I had argued, of course, that AGOA was a poverty alleviation initiative and not a pro-democracy initiative. Because, in fact, when it was approved, the four oldest democracies in Africa, some of the most democratic countries of the continent, such as Botswana, Namibia, South Africa, and Mauritius, were left out. They didn't qualify. That was because AGOA was not a pro-democracy initiative, but a poverty alleviation initiative. And so, I welcome the undertaking of the president that he's going to take initiatives specifically to promote democracy, accountability, responsibility, promote the rule of law, and transparency. I agree. However, I couldn't help noticing that the president addressed himself to the issue of corruption for the first time when he reached sub-Saharan Africa. When he had been to the Middle East, to Turkey, to Russia, to Europe, including Britain. Britain, where parliamentarians have been doing their own thing. Germany, where Siemens has been indicted for corruption. Russia and the Middle East, who are not known for their anti-corruption probity. So, while it is right and proper that the president should have raised these questions of corruption, the fact that he only raised it when he got to Africa would seems to me have the effect of perpetuating the misconception that corruption exists only in Africa. I just mentioned that in passing. He has urged us to do a number of things that are right. And I agree with him that we have to pull ourselves by our bootstraps. All I can say is that, yes, we have to do that. However, it's nice to be able to do that when we have a friendly United States, such as the hardworking people of Israel. They do things for themselves, but by God, they have very facilitative and supportive policies from the United States. The Germans are known as a leading nation, always have been. They recovered from the destruction of the war again because there was substantial assistance from the United States. But I agree that we should be given assistance only if we are going to make good use of it. And so, as I say, all the points that I had raised, well, there are details, of course, I had raised what we expect regarding the present credit crunch, for which we were not responsible, and again, which we Africans have suffered more than most because of our excessive dependence on commodities, where we are price takers. But otherwise, I agree with him that we must start from the simple premise that Africa's future is up to the Africans themselves. And so, in regard to the statements that I had made and the statement and the address that the president has given, we remain satisfied that our legitimate expectations are likely to be realized. He has promised $3.5 billion with regard to food production, has agreed that he has set aside an additional $63 billion for health, to fight AIDS, tuberculosis, malaria, and neglected tropical diseases. He has emphasized the fight against corruption, against dictatorship, and said that good governance will be the sole condition of American partnership with Africa. I can only agree that that should be the case. And so, improvement in the quality of aid, increases in the quantum of assistance, and the assistance for African democratization is something also of which I had spoken, and I am grateful. When he speaks about strong men, or the continent deserving strong institutions rather than strong men, we agree with him because we remember personalities who would have been icons had they not overstayed their welcome, lost their vision, and betrayed their mission. Names of people like Sekou Touré come to mind, Camus Banda, and now Robert Mugabe. That's very true. We can't deny that. He made reference to the brain drain, and therefore agrees that it was important to train Africans and desist from taking them away from their own country to the United States, even though they must not be discriminated against. That, again, is something that is good. He spoke about conflicts, conflict prevention, management, and resolution by peaceful negotiation. We agree. And so, in short, that's what we feel about the president. I'm making my remarks somewhat short and somewhat disjointed because I want you to be able to ask me questions so that we can interact. Then I will respond very fully to specific questions that you will ask. Because when we do that and interact, we will live here knowing each other better. But of course, there is a longish written text which I will leave with the center. I thank you. I'm willing to take questions.
Country. And the next question, I didn't hear the first part. Did you hear the first part? Okay.
Sir, I didn't hear
what type of government-sponsored program do you have, retirement program do you have in your country, which is similar to our Social Security? And the other question was, in view of the fact that you have all that wealth and diamonds, do you have an army, and what is their mission?
We do have some social security programs. I don't know the extent to which they are similar to yours. We have destitution relief. People who are destitute get some payment from government. They are registered and they get payment from government. It's called destitution relief. We also have a non-contributory old age pension. It's nominal in terms of the amount you receive in your country, but when you reach the age of 65, you become eligible for the non-contributory old age pension. We are also one of the countries that have been seriously affected by HIV and AIDS. Consequently, we register all orphans. Originally, because orphaned by the AIDS epidemic, but then all orphans are eligible for allowances from government for food, for clothing, for education. It was thought that it's better to look after the orphans in the care of the relatives rather than build institutions. And so that's exactly what we are doing. So when children are orphaned, they are registered. The counselor The member of parliament of the area would encourage the family, and now the families automatically know that they are entitled to register the children so they can get monthly rations, so they get clothing, and then school fees until they are 18. So those are some of the social security arrangements that we have. Now you said because we are rich, do we have an army? We are not rich. Being a middle-income country doesn't mean that you are rich. It means that in a continent of poor countries, you are better than some. However, yes, we do have an army. Its mission, it was created during the bad old days when we were surrounded by hostile racist regimes. We were surrounded by apartheid South Africa on three sides, to the south and east, and to the west, because they controlled what is now Namibia, then Southwest Africa. And then to the northeast, we had this racist Smith regime. Now, we knew very well that we had no chance of being able to fight and hold back these guys if they invaded us. But we thought that we would discourage wanton raids by bands of their soldiers, and that if they came in and were at least able to kill some of them too, it would give the international community time to come to our assistance. We did not have an army until about 1976, when it was decided that, no, we must have some kind of army to be able to at least hold, in the case of small invasions, hold them while ringing the Secretary General of the United Nations. So that was its mission. But we are very proud of it because it's a very disciplined army, subordinate to civil authority. And we use it for things like firefighting, fighting veiled fires, and assisting the police occasionally in fighting organized crime. And when I was president, the air wing of the army flew me all over the world, and I was proud to arrive here, be received in some of your air bases, flown by all my own countrymen. That's the vanity I talked about. Yes, sir.
Yes, my name is Jacob Azeke. I was born in Nigeria, retired from New York Public Library, active in union movement. Now, in terms of land use and development in Africa, what are we doing to educate our people in terms of giving up the land for development? As you know, Nigeria, land is very sacred because it's passed from one generation after generation, and giving up land for development, it's a big fight. What are we doing to educate the people of Africa about giving up land for development?
We are doing a lot. In fact, early this year in April, we held a conference on land reform and management in Berlin, because it was the 125th anniversary of the Berlin Conference, which drew the boundaries of Africa. We realized that the ownership of land, its management, its distribution in all African countries is suboptimal. In Botswana, we are a country roughly the size of France, Belgium, and the Netherlands together. And we are less than 2 million. And yet it is said that there is a shortage of land. France has 60 million people. Now, admittedly, Botswana is a semi-arid area. But surely, there cannot be a shortage of land in Botswana with less than 2 million people. The shortage is in our heads. So yes, we are trying in different countries in different ways to educate the people about the conservation of land and the necessity to have title to pieces of land because it is an asset that can be used. I think in Botswana, we have been relatively successful. I visited Bayelsa State last month. I got the impression that they are doing, at least what they told me, that they are doing exactly the same thing, trying to regularize the management of land. And they have recognized that land is a very, very important asset. Because in any case, in countries like Nigeria, but like in all countries, you know, in spite of all these tropical diseases and things in Africa, the population of Africa is increasing exponentially. And the land is not expanding. It's not elastic. Therefore, we're going to have to accommodate much larger populations within the same quantity of land. And different governments are undertaking programs of land reform intended to improve its management and utilization. And nowadays, some of us are also concerned about its conservation. Because, again, to give your country, because you mentioned it, there is a lot of land degradation in Nigeria, especially in the oil areas. The non-governmental organizations, of course, are drawing attention to this. But it's not the fault of the oil companies alone. I think the people themselves, as you rightly recognize, had previously not used the land as well as they should have done. But I cannot say that the programs are uniform in your country because the states are relatively autonomous. But I have met a number of state governors who are acutely aware of the necessity to educate the people about the importance of conserving the land, managing it, and also distributing it fairly. Sir.
Hello, Your Excellency. My name is John Fullwood. I'd like to ask you a question. In the in your introduction, it was stated that your country gained its freedom in 1966. Is that correct?
Yes.
And the film stated that you discovered diamonds in a year later in 1967. I wonder, is it your opinion that your country could have gained its freedom had the diamonds been found first? And also, I'd like to, as a follow-up question, ask about tourism for those of us who are of African descent who might like to visit Botswana. Do they speak English? What kind of things would we need to know if we wanted to visit your country?
I think that if diamonds had been discovered earlier, I suppose it would depend how soon earlier. If it had been discovered, let's say, in the 20s, we probably would be part of South Africa. Because actually the part of South Africa nowadays called two provinces, one called the Northwest, the other called the Northern Cape. Those are Botswana. They were Southern Botswana. And after the Berlin Conference of 1884, in 1895, three of our chiefs, accompanied by missionaries, went to the United Kingdom to seek the British Queen's protection from the Queen's subjects, especially in the person of a gentleman called John Cecil Rhodes, who had a program. He said his mission was to extend the British influence from the Cape to Cairo. If you go to Cape Town today in South Africa, in another town just to the south of our capital called Mafeking, and another town called Bulawayo in Zimbabwe, and another town called Livingstone in Zambia, you will find the statues of John Cecil Rhodes with his hand like this, facing to the north, because that was his mission. Now, what happened was that, to cut the long story short, the chiefs were granted protection. So the northern part of the country became a protectorate. The southern part became a colony. And when the Union of South Africa was created in 1910, after the Anglo-Boer War, the Bechuanaland, the protectorate, as we were called, they called it Bechuanaland. They didn't actually intend to change the name. It's just, you know, English people are very poor in pronouncing other people's names. So they wanted to say Botswana land, even though grammatically that, again, is not necessary because Botswana means the land of the Botswana. But logically, at least, they were from England, and then they think, therefore, Botswana land. So Botswana land, which became known as British Botswana land, which was a crown colony, became part of South Africa in 1910. Up until then, it was just Botswana land, from the town of Kimberley to our present northern boundary. But you will remember also that it was in 1867 that diamonds were discovered in Kimberley in the then British Botswana land. And so when the Union of South Africa was created, Botswana land, the colony, became part of the Union of South Africa. But Botswana land, the protectorate, the British Act of Parliament creating the Union of South Africa said that in the case of the protectorate, it shall not be incorporated without consultation with the natives. In those days and in the 20s and 30s, we were natives, but in the 50s we became Bantu. And so when General Herzog in 36 and 24, and finally Dr. Malang in 1956 tried to incorporate us, we refused. And the highest court in Britain, the Privy Council, ruled that the proviso which said that we would not be incorporated into South Africa without consultation with us meant that we could not be incorporated without our consent. But we consistently refused. But you are right. If the diamonds had been discovered earlier, your guess is as good as mine as to whether we would have got our independence when we did. In the event, it was discovered after we became independent. What was the second part of your question, Agreed?
Tell us about how
tourism. Yes, we have a tourism industry based on wildlife and wilderness. I told you there are 2 million of us in a country about the size of France or the state of Texas, and concentrated on the eastern seaboard. And so there are large, and 33% of the land mass is reserved for game parks and nature reserves. And therefore, those are our tourism products. At present, we have the largest number of elephants at 150,000. We are constantly negotiating with an international organization called CITES. That is the Convention on something Endangered Species, whereby we try to get permission to sell a certain quantity of ivory. Occasionally, we are given permission to do so, but only if we sell to Japan. The rest of the ivory, we must build storage, which must be inspected by inspectors from CITES to see that we are collecting it, we are documenting it, because we have this largest number of elephants. But it's not only elephants. We have lots of leopards, cheetahs, lions. Well, I just mentioned the cats.
Okay.
But otherwise, we have the buffalo, eland, giraffe, etc. Ah. I think so. No, they do speak English. Our literacy rate at present is close to 90%, partly because of our education and training has been a priority, and partly because we're a very young population. Therefore, a substantial proportion of the population was born at or after independence. And therefore, they have been to school, and English is the official language. We have two official languages. It is English and Setswana.
Dumela re mo kae?
Dumela mma.
My name is Iyabo Babatunde. And I'm not sure if you remember me, but my sister and I met you in Botswana this summer through our aunt, Auntie Sheila. And my question is, what do you think the role is for the youth like me for our part in developing Africa? Our role in developing Africa.
I think the role of the youth like you is to take advantage of the opportunities that now exist, that used not to exist when I was your age. I didn't start school until I was 11. But today, children start school when they are 6. Those from other parents, of course, started 5 and a half. But if you are older than 7, you are denied access. But my generation, even though I started school when I was 11, there were others who started school even later than that. And so I just envy you the opportunities that you have. I didn't know how to use a telephone until I was 20-something, because there was no telephone at my house, in my parents' house. But you are born with cell phones, computers. Mention it, you have it. And so make use of these opportunities. And there is a lot to be done in Africa because we are still underdeveloped. One, Africa is a place of contrast. In some ways, it's a very frustrating thing. It's very frustrating because of primitive infrastructure in some ways. In others, it's very exciting because actually you can make an impact as an individual much more than you can do here in a country like this, where there are millions of brilliant people with many, many ideas, and so much has been done. You have to be exceptionally bright to... But in Africa, it's not like that. It's easier to make an impact because there is so much to be done to improve the condition and raise the standards of living of the people. So we are very proud of you, and we expect that you will take advantage of the opportunities that are available and therefore contribute to the development of Africa.
Thank you.
Okay.
Your Excellency, my name is Dr. Joe Opaku. I'm the publisher of the Third Press and president of Telecom Africa Corporation. I happen to be Nigerian as well. As you know, there's one out of every five Africans is a Nigerian, so it's to be expected. But I also happen to have a Ghanaian pedigree as well. So I think that apropos your earlier comment in your speech, there's a long road from Ghana to Nigeria, and it does pass through Botswana. So we can accommodate it. I just have really two comments. First of all, I feel quite privileged to come after this young lady, because they are our future. And I believe that amongst their obligation, they must refuse to allow us pass on excuses to them that we've passed amongst ourselves for not doing what we know we can do and ought to do. I had an opportunity 4 days after 9/11 to give a speech in Geneva. It was called The Right of Ownership of Problems as Intellectual Property. I basically argued that creativity and innovation come from problem solving. So if you steal my problem, you cause me two new problems. You deprive me of opportunity for innovation, and you leave me with the residual guilt of incompetence. And if you solve my problem and it fails, you also give me a triple whammy. So my challenge is this. It has not been acknowledged that Africa has, if you take the entire diaspora at home and worldwide, we have more than the minimum capacity of expertise needed to abandon poverty management and to create globally competitive capacity building. We're trying to actually create a project called Project R&D, which is how to create research capacity in every field in some part of Africa. And your vision, which I know of and I'm very proud of, because time has come for us to acknowledge African leaders rather than partisan, national leaders. We want to mobilize Africa now to once and for all go for it, go to the cutting edge, and just become globally competitive. I'd like your views on that.
Yes, I would encourage you in doing that. I agree, although no man is an island, and therefore we have to cooperate with the rest of humanity in solving problems, we nevertheless have enough. We are not making optimum use of the technical competence at our disposal. We are mismanaging our human resources. The many constraints that have been cited by the president, such as conflict, corruption, lack of imagination that has resulted in people of Africans being denied jobs in their own countries or denied the possibilities of displaying creativity at home and therefore going abroad. And therefore, as we democratize, and many African countries are democratizing, I know there have been coups in Mauritania, Madagascar, Guinea-Bissau, and Guinea, and there are problems in Sudan, of course, and the failed state of Somalia. But that is not the totality of us. There are many countries which are managing their affairs relatively efficiently, and it's a trend. So I agree that we should do more to make better use of our human resources. But as I say, we have to collaborate not only with the diaspora, people of African origin elsewhere, a movement of which I'm a member, but with everybody else. But of course, charity begins at home. We can only be partner with other people if we have some contribution of our own. So I agree with you entirely.
Thank you very much.
Good evening, Your Excellency. Ladies and gentlemen, my name is Kaza Mulebala Mulebala, raised and born in Sleepy Pikwe, Botswana. Thank you. My question, first of all, I'd like to congratulate you on this great honor tonight, and I would like to say personally, I am very inspired. My question is, during your presidency, did you have any policies that you strategized with this problem that we have of African leaders or African presidents who in turn have too much power and they overstay, they stay in their term in office? Do you have any policies that you made or maybe in paper or you try to implement, and what were the problems that you were facing in your efforts to try to make sure that Botswana does not become a victim or be victimized of such problems in the future of dictatorship? Thank you.
I don't know how I could have done that for Africa as a whole, but if you mean with respect to Botswana, I respected the rule of law. The judges were independent. The press was free, and I debated with them. I didn't always agree with them. And we made laws that were passed by Parliament. And I hoped that, following on the footsteps of my predecessors, I think that we have established a tradition whereby we are elected to power. What we did do, of course, we introduced term limits. The first president died in office after 14 years. The second president retired on his own after 18 years. I was the first to retire after 10 years under the new provision of the Constitution. And it is my expectation that my successor will, when the time comes, do so. And at present, we have a vibrant press, and the people know what they are entitled to. My own feeling is that as a small country, we could only lead by precept and example. And I thought that in my humble way, I have demonstrated to my countrymen and women that you can hold office and retire when your time comes, judging by the generosity when I retired, I have the distinct impression that they like what I did. Because all over the country, they gave me cattle, because we are a cattle people. We export beef to the UK and Germany. They gave me 180 cattle, 120 goats, 36 sheep, 4 donkeys, 2 pigs, 4 ostriches. So, by biblical standards, I must be a rich man.
Okay, good evening, Your Excellency. My name is Stephen Sutherland.
Excuse me just a minute. I'm going to ask that the 4 people who are here come forward and ask the questions. Will you take the time to answer those 4?
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, good evening, Your Excellency. My name is Stephen Sutherland. I overheard an African once said that within 50 years, Africans will be speaking Chinese. My question to you, to what extent is China involved in the trade and development in Botswana, and what is your overall opinion of China in Africa right now?
China has been involved with Botswana since about 1976. Our relationship with China is not ideological. They gave us some aid. We trade with them, as everybody else does nowadays. They are not involved in any major project in Botswana at the present time, but we welcome their coming into the world's markets because it had the effect of raising the prices of our commodities, such as copper and nickel. And so we think that the coming of China is a good thing. I was giving a lecture at the National Defense College Intelligence in Washington, and somebody asked me, if we were asked to choose between China and the United States, which one would you choose? I said I would choose both. That's because there is nothing in our history as Africans to make us naive to believe that the Chinese are any different from other people with whom we have interacted in the past. And so, we welcome them. We are fellow human beings. Yes, we have to try and learn Chinese. Those of you, especially those who are young, to be able to learn Chinese. My daughter is in Shanghai doing exactly that. She tried to go there and do a degree in Sino-Africa relations. And they said she has to study Mandarin first. So between now and the end of next year, she has to do Mandarin. So far, so good. Whether she will ultimately pass, I don't know. But she does know practical Chinese. And so that's what I think of the Chinese. The President Obama today at the UN said so that we are all human beings. We have to do things together, not against each other, but with each other.
Good evening, Your Excellency. My name is African George. I'm curious to inquire that you mentioned several presidents, heads of states, that were revolutionists and that took their country from oppression, and you stated that they stayed too long. Now, if they were wise enough to take their country out of oppression, why would you comment that several of them are staying too long when they shed their blood for their country?
That's because that's exactly what happened. They ended up undoing some of the good that they had done. Sekou Touré, let's take Sekou Touré. Sekou Touré stood against France. He refused the package that France, that De Gaulle, was offering all the countries, the French colonies in Africa. And he was ostracized. And he became a hero. But in later years, he became a dictator, vicious dictator. He himself actually executed some of the people with whom he had worked, like the first Secretary General of the Organization of African Unity.
Sing-ho?
He killed him. Therefore,
are you speaking of Sing-ho?
Therefore, I say, no, not Sing-ho, Sekou Touré.
No, you were speaking about he executed the Secretary General of Senegal.
No, sir. Let me repeat. I say Sekou Touré.
Yes.
Would have been an icon had he ruled for 20 years and left and maybe prepared for his own succession. But he stayed in power on and on. No man can know the problems of the country all his lifetime. Situations change, and other people who understand, who are more current, come up. And if you don't allow them to participate, and you oppress and suppress them as he did, it is unfortunate. He impoverished his country. That's why I say it is a pity.
And had he not challenged the French,
sir, had he done what?
Had he not challenged the French?
Has he not challenged?
If he didn't challenge the French in a revolution, what would the state be now?
I don't know. I don't know.
Oh, you
I don't
know.
If
and the second point, if the second you, point is Mugabe. In Zimbabwe, you spoke about him being in office too long also. And he also shed his blood, his fellow countrymen, and the West is denying access to his products. They stole the land. They lied about giving him money for the land if he returned it to the white folks there. And they didn't do it. And you commented that he stayed too long. And he too shed his blood for his country.
Do you know what, sir? Don't go away. Don't go away. Let's communicate.
Good evening, sir. My name is Onelina Babatunde. My father is Nigerian and my mother is South African, though she has lived in Botswana for many years. I noticed that whenever we go to Nigeria, when we get out of the airport, it doesn't look like it runs well, and the streets look dirty, and it's hard to get transportation. But when we go to Botswana, it is clean, and it's easy to get transportation, and it runs well. And I was just wondering why that was, because I knew that Nigeria has a surplus of oil. So I was wondering what the difference was between those two countries and why that was.
I think it's changing in Nigeria. It's a much bigger country, and initially the infrastructure was overwhelmed. But gradually, they are modernizing the infrastructure. If you go to Abuja, you'll find it's clean, more or less like Harbor Road. But the older cities like Ibadan and especially Lagos. They're overcrowded, and a special effort is needed to refurbish the infrastructure and to keep it clean. But they are doing their best.
Good evening, Mr. President. In terms of accountability, I realize there's a theme going throughout the world of global accountability. And I also realize that you have mentioned democratization throughout most of your speech. Are you suggesting that the first step towards development in Africa would be democratization, and then that would trickle down to economic development and also helping to alleviate poverty, or would this be something that would be done simultaneously?
No, these things are not sequential.
Okay.
They are simultaneous. You practice development democratically. You involve the people you are trying to help in whatever it is you are trying to help. You try to carry them with you. You try to convince them and allow yourself to be convinced by them regarding what is the most appropriate thing to do, what is the optimum utilization of the totality of resources at your disposal. So it's not development first and then democracy, or democracy first, then development. It's development being done democratically, that is collaboration with other people.
Also, I have several other questions. Would I be able to ask in the interest of time?
Yeah, do ask it.
Separately? I know people want to go home, so I don't want to take... Would I be able to ask?
Yes, ask.
I also realize that the some international organizations play a major role in setting standards for different parts of the world. And, for example, you have the MDG goals, which, in my opinion, sometimes seem a little bit unrealistic. I may be a little biased. But to what extent is Africa, for example, involved in setting the goals for some of these standards that are actually set? For example, with education as one of the MDG goals.
I think education is it's a realistic target, and Africans were involved. But you are right, of course, the performance of different countries differs. And some targets for some countries, you may well be right, they may be unrealistic. But they were desirable ones anyway. Thank you.
Let's have another round of applause for the president. I know, I don't know about you, but I've been informed, learned an awful lot, and know that there's much, much more to learn, both through speeches such as this, but also through going to Botswana. So put Botswana on your map of places to go and see for yourself. I'm going to ask before we leave that you remain in your seats until the president is able to get to the outside. And we thank you for coming out and joining us this evening. And we trust that we can expect you to be back here at the Schomburg Center many, many more times this year. Thank you so much, and have a wonderful evening.
Thank you.